It just occurred to me last night as I was working on getting this thing together that last Thursday was my 9th anniversary of ordination as a pastor. And, you know, it just kind of blew by. Thanks. I wasn't just trying to get an applause here. I have a point. But thank you. It's amazing how much time has passed how quickly. I couldn't believe it. All of a sudden I reflected on it. I had to go look at the certificate to see, yeah, it was 2002. Oh my gosh. And so much has changed, and yet so much has stayed the same in other respects too. It's been kind of, it was an interesting evening just kind of thinking through these issues. 9 years ago, my hair was all dark. And I was thinking, okay, did pastoring whiten my hair? Or maybe it was raising two teenagers. I really give more of the credit to that. But also things have stayed the same. So many of the issues that I was dealing with 9 years ago, I'm still dealing with today. Both in myself, unfortunately, at least the unfortunate ones, but also in the people that I work with and the people that I counsel with. It's amazing how much sameness there is in human nature. In the spirit of just mankind. I was thinking about, as a pastor, if I had just one message, one gift that I could give to the people that I'm working with, you know, that one that you take to a desert island, and it's just the one that you have, what would it be? And I realized right off the bat that that hasn't changed at all in the last 10 years. In fact, it hasn't changed in the last 15 years for me, personally, because it's the one thing that's been driving me. It was the one thing that saved my life in a very real respect. It's the one thing that gave life back to me in a very real respect. And it's the thing that's been animating my work as a pastor. I'd like to say that I figured this out and it was why I wanted to become a pastor, but it didn't actually work that way. You know, it was really almost 10 years from the time that I started working toward being ordained in a kind of a haphazard way and finally getting the first glimpse of what this is all about. And as I was thinking last night, the best way that I can put it to you is that I would give you a way to find the face of God if there was just one thing that I could give you. And I thought about the different ways that I could say that. I could say, yeah, the love of God, the compassion of God, the acceptance of God. But I think it's more than just that, because that implies you understanding something with your head. But finding the face of God implies that you have actually seen Him. You know something about Him beyond what you think. You have felt, absorbed, experienced who this God is. Because until we do that, nothing changes. And when we do that, everything changes. When we have finally seen the face of God, like Moses coming down the mountain, you know, the change of appearance, there is something different about us. We do not leave an encounter with our God unchanged. It's not possible if it's an authentic encounter. And so I was thinking back 9 years, and just after I was ordained, I remember it was interesting that people related to me a little different. Some of it was negative, but a lot of it was positive in that they felt more open to share things with me. And I remember this woman came up who was in her mid-60s, late-60s, I suppose, and she confided in me one Sunday morning in a back corner that after 40 years in the church, 4 decades of going to church, she still wasn't sure if she was saved. It just kind of blew me away because she was one of the sweetest, nicest people that I knew, one of the most stalwart people within the church. And what she was confessing, we got to think about what that meant to her when she said it. It meant that she wasn't sure that when she died, if her God would send her to everlasting torment and throw away the key. That's what she meant by that statement. She wasn't sure. After 40 years, I'm thinking, how is this possible? And what a tragedy is this? That after 40 years, she wouldn't know if she had that acceptance, that basic acceptance of her God. A couple years later, I was at it was a study of sorts, and another pastor was leading. And he just commented that when he's in worship and he holds his hands up, that he holds them up to show God that they're clean. You know, kind of like a child showing his parents, his mother, that, hands are clean so you can have dinner, that he was clean and that he was acceptable. And again, I thought, when my little boy, my 15-year-old, who was then probably 5 or 6, raises his hands up to me, it's just because he wants to be picked up and held. It has nothing to do with anything else. And how do we get so turned around that even our worship becomes trying to show God that we've accomplished something so that we can be acceptable to him? How does that happen? It happens because we haven't seen the face of God. We don't know who he is. We haven't felt all of that. And what remains the same is that I'm still hearing these same issues over and over again. I was talking to a young man just a few weeks ago. Good-looking, intelligent kid. I say kid to me. And yet he said, you know, I've been an addict. I've been addicted to all sorts of different things in my life. So many things have gone wrong. I've done so much. I've left this trail of tears behind me. I don't even know if what I believe about God, but one thing, I can't imagine how any God could forgive the things that I've done. I can't imagine how any God could find me acceptable with everything that I've done. I was working with a young couple, and this couple was telling me their story. And they had come out of addiction, and yet the young man, the husband, had had a conversion experience, a really strong one that made him one of those kind of obnoxious Christians for a while, where he was just so gung-ho. And his poor wife didn't know what in the world had changed, and she's trying to catch up with him, and she's trying to understand. And she told me she was raised in an atheist background, so it really was just shifting gears for her. And yet she hung with him, and she saw that there was something different about him. Something had changed. And yet at the same time, he was trying so hard to atone for all the things that he had done in his past as he perceived them. And now 4 or 5 years later, they're in my office because they've relapsed. They're back into the old patterns again. And yet it's worse now because they both know what it felt like to be clean. They know what it felt like to have a relationship that was built on something real. But now they're back into this. And I looked, especially in the young man's eyes, and I saw that just self-torment, that self-loathing, because he knew that he had something real, and he lost it. And now he was worse than he was before, because how could God ever forgive him, not only for the things he did, but the things he continued to do after he should have known better? These are the things that keep coming up over and over again. Who among us hasn't felt worthless? Who among us hasn't felt unworthy? Who among us hasn't felt unlovable, unacceptable, disgusting, loathful? Who among us hasn't felt that? You know, our whole lives add up to feeling that way, don't they? When you were a child, who among us hasn't felt the unacceptance of a parent at times, even if it was mild, and sometimes it's not mild? When our parents divorce, when our parents drink, when our parents berate us, what is that telling us? Life, implicitly or explicitly, is always telling us there's something wrong with you. When we get dumped by a lover, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, when we get divorced, when we don't get the job that we want and somebody else gets it, when we don't get picked on the soccer team or we get picked last, when we're too fat or too skinny or too whatever and we feel on the outside looking in, what has life taught us about ourselves? Over and over again, life has taught us, you don't measure up, you're not worthy. You don't make the grade. And if you don't do better, if you don't look better, if you don't perform better, if you're not smarter, if you're not whatever, fill in the blank, then you're not going to be accepted. And the heartbreak goes deeper and deeper and deeper. Our whole world is based on performance, isn't it? We are rewarded or punished based on performance. How well we do, how much we don't do. Winners and losers. On and off, binary, ones and zeros. Nothing in between. And we learn that lesson so well, we apply it everywhere we go. Our families are based on that. Our governments are based on that. And our church is based on that, regardless of what it says. Our church uses the law to divide winners and losers. How well are you doing? You better do this. You better not do that. God, like the ultimate Santa Claus up there checking his list twice, is going to get you. And we grow up this way, feeling this way about our God. The church uses performance, but it doesn't even stop there. If only it were that simple, that we're guilty because we don't perform well. But what has the church said over the centuries? That we're even guilty just because we were born. This notion of original sin. This notion that just because we were born to Adam, that we have this sin in us. And different Christians all over the world think about it differently. Some of it's fairly benign. Well, that's more of a sin nature. It's a predilection towards sin. It's just the weakness that we have inherently. And the Eastern Church feels that way, the Eastern Orthodox Church. But the Western Church, the Roman Church, the one that we're descended from through Protestantism, they took a very different tact. It wasn't just original sin, it was original guilt. We were guilty because the DNA that came from Adam to us made us so. Why do you think the Catholics baptize infants as soon as they possibly can? Because we are born guilty. We are born depraved. We are born in such a state that if we die without baptism, we go straight to hell. The Catholic doctrine for a while was that infants unbaptized would go to hell. It just defies all logic. But it didn't have anything to do with performance. It didn't have anything to do with even being at the age of reason where you could make some sort of choice. It simply had to do with being born. Then they came up with limbo to kind of save the kids. You know, they go to limbo. We don't know what that means, but we're going to soften a little bit. And today, things have softened somewhat. But John Calvin in the 16th century, splitting off. Martin Luther, splitting off. Their notions were very, very much in terms of total depravity. To the point that in Calvinism, once we are born in total depravity, we don't even have the freedom, the option, the choice to do anything different. We are who we are. It's so difficult to even logically think about a system like that, and yet we are heirs to it. And as I say these things, you might be shaking your head and say, well, that's ridiculous, I don't believe in that. But I'll tell you what, because we're swimming in this soup, because we're swimming in this culture, because you've been in church possibly for the last 20 or 30 years, it's in there. You picked it up. It is coloring the way that you feel about yourself, and it's coloring the way that you feel about your relationship with your God. There is something fundamentally wrong with me. And God sees that. God knows that. Jonathan Edwards in the 18th century, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, using the analogy of God holding us like a loathsome spider or insect over a fire that he couldn't even stand to touch. That doesn't just go away when it's been part of us for generations, centuries, and millennia. This is what we have to think about. And yet, what was Jesus talking about? Original sin doesn't even appear in the Bible as a concept or as a term. And the Hebrews don't even believe in it at all. And Jesus was a Jew. We're born bad. We're born depraved. What does Genesis 1 say? That God looked at his creation and said that it was good. That's what the Hebrews believe. God's creation is good. God doesn't make dirt. Well, he makes dirt. He doesn't make dirty people. What he makes is good. He approves. Yes, we have a choice, and yes, we are weak, and yes, we make choices that take us into separation from this goodness, but it's still there. And the most important thing is, how does God look at his creation? How does he look at his people? Does he see them as disgusting and loathsome when they're not doing what he knows they should be doing, what he designed them to do? You know, the very words good and evil in Aramaic give us an insight, a hint into the way that God sees us. Good and evil, taba and bisha, in Aramaic and in Hebrew, don't mean good and evil the way we think of it, as against some standard out there, some objective standard. And does it measure up or not? It simply means ripe or unripe. It means functional or dysfunctional. It means mature or immature. It means in time, in harmony, or out of harmony and out of time. There is a continuum between unripe and ripe, and we're someplace on that continuum. That's how God sees us. Becoming in a process, not yet ready for everything that He has for us, but becoming, and with His drawing, always knowing that the possibility is there for us. If you have a child who is less than 2 years old and is wearing diapers, are you angry at that child because it's incontinent? Are you angry at that child because it can't use the potty yet? I mean, we understand that synapses and nerve endings haven't fused yet. They cannot connect these things. They do not have the ability. And so we're not angry. We just change their diapers. God understands that about us. He knows our frailties. He created us. He sees us as His beloved children in this process. He hurts with us when we hurt. He celebrates with us when we celebrate. He never sees us as disgusting or loathsome any more than we see our children. Jesus said, if you who are evil, now parse that, you who are unripe, you who are not yet ready for prime time, you who can't do what you were designed to do yet, if you know how to give good things to your children, how much more does your Father in heaven know how to give good things to you? The analogy is there. Jesus is trying to show us, this is how your Father sees you, as I see you. And Jesus' model was so stark that He would sit down with anyone. He would break all the rules of His cultural etiquette to talk to a woman in public, to talk to a Samaritan woman, to not only talk to a Roman centurion, but to heal His servant. Constantly going, breaking boundaries, moving toward the other, sitting with anyone who would sit with Him. He's showing us the face of His Father, showing us the face of God, by showing us His face, because He and the Father are one. Somehow we've got to get to the point where we can understand that we don't have to do anything to get God's acceptance, to get God's love. It just is. It's there. And anything that we do to try to get it is just an exercise in futility. In fact, it's worse than that, because it's driving us in the other direction, driving us further and further away from the face of our God, the face that shows us how much love, how much joy and acceptance there is in that face. If we could just approach it, if just for an instant we could see Him, see those eyes, see what He has for us in those eyes. When I was starting this journey 20 years ago, and I was just a mess, I got introduced to three mentors whom I never met because it was all in writing. And one of them was Thomas Merton, one of them was Henry Nouwen, and the third was Brennan Manning. And Brennan Manning has been, it's hard to describe, he feels like a father, he feels like a brother. He feels like the face of Christ to me in so many ways. He was a Franciscan priest himself. He actually started out as a Marine, fought in the Korean War, came back, and in 1956, only a week after I was born, getting old, he calls it being ambushed by Christ. He had an experience in a church that just turned and spun him around. And he entered the Franciscan order, and he became a Franciscan priest, and his life was an incredible journey. Worldwide missions all over the place where he was stationed. And then finally taking a break from his pastoral duties and just living in Spain and carrying water for the poor indigent people there and spending 6 months in a cave and doing all these things and then coming back to the United States and starting ministries in the South, in Louisiana and Florida and Alabama. And then somehow, somewhere, some way along the way, he lost it. And by the mid-70s, he was so deep into his alcoholism that he was living on the street, literally, homeless, in Fort Lauderdale, sleeping in gutters, sleeping in alleys, sleeping in doorways, sleeping wherever he could in abandoned buildings. This man who had experienced all of this is now lying in a gutter, in a doorway, with vomit all over the front of his shirt, the smell of someone who hasn't showered in weeks, reeking of it, bleary eyes, waking up in the morning, looking through, as he says, an alcoholic fog. And coming up the sidewalk, he sees this young, attractive 25-year-old woman with a 5-year-old boy in her arms, or carrying him, or leading him by the hand. And somehow the boy breaks away and runs over to where he is and is just looking at him. And the woman, you know, shrieks and runs and grabs him. Get away from there! Get away from there! You know, that's just disgusting. Get away from there. And here's Brennan Manning, Franciscan priest, sitting there taking the butt of what she has to say and believing somewhere inside that it's got to be true. I can still smell, he said. I know it's true. In that same period of time, he talks about his best friend, his best male friend, who lived in Mobile, Alabama at the time. His name is Paul Sheldon. And he said that in that state, who he was, right then and right there, on his own dime, Paul would fly every 2 weeks from Mobile to Fort Lauderdale and come and find Brennan wherever he was in the streets and just sit on the curb with him, drape his arm around his stinking shoulders, and not lecture him or try to change him, but just sit with him and tell him, Brennan, I love you. It's going to be all right. And take him to get a decent meal. Take him to get a shower. And then come back 2 weeks later and 2 weeks later. Brennan said, for me, Paul was the face of Christ. Paul was the face of God. Have you ever had a friend like that? You know, we don't have to have such spectacularly crazy stories in order to realize that we have friends like that. Some of you have stories like Brennan Manning's. Some of you have stories worse than Brennan Manning's. And some of you are wondering if God can ever forgive the stinking carcass that you view yourself as or were. But as Brennan said, God loved me as much at that moment, laying in that gutter with that disgusted woman hovering over me, as he does right now as he stands and talks to tens of thousands of people every year with all of his books in worldwide circulation. There's no difference. And Paul, his friend, was the one who bridged that gap for him. He was his friend no matter what. Have you had a friend like that? Can you remember a time when somebody was just there for you, there with you, not trying to change you, not trying to do anything, but just be with you, and through that let you know that you are acceptable just as you are, not as you should be, just as you are, right here, right now, nothing you need to do. I got an email just 2 to 3 weeks ago from a gay man who was calling to ask about our church, because he said he really felt like he wanted to be in church, but he didn't know where to go because he knew how Christians felt about gays. And some of the churches that he tried before, even the ones that would welcome him initially, it was like there was a time limit. There was an egg timer going someplace in the back of their minds and hearts that you need to get fixed. And we expect you to get fixed so that you can fit in here, so that you can stay here. And he felt that constant pressure, that constant nagging impetus to be something other than he was. And maybe he will change, but he didn't feel comfortable there. And how do we feel about it? And what's our policy? What's our beliefs? And is this some place that he could come? I told him, absolutely. You are most welcome here. You're most welcome for as long as you want to be here. And regardless of what you do, you're welcome here. Where else would we rather have you be than with us and in community? Do you have a friend like that? Do you have someone who just accepts you no matter what? How are these unconditional friends even possible? If you can remember someone like that in your life, if you can remember a time when you were that friend, how is that even possible? It's only possible in people who have gotten a glimpse of God's face, who understand the acceptance that they have so that they can give it to somebody else. We can only give what we've got to give if we don't feel and know that we are accepted just as we are. How in the world can we give it to anybody else? Seeing the face of God is the first step of understanding how this life can be lived, what this kingdom is all about, and what Jesus is talking about anyway. Brendan says a really interesting thing. He says, God expects more failure from us than we expect from ourselves. Think about that for a second. God expects more failure from us than we expect from ourselves. God knows just how weak we are. God knows better how weak we are and how much relapse is a part of recovery. It's going to happen. You know, just make friends with that fact. You're going to blow it. It's going to happen over and over again. We're human. We are going to move in and out of phase with that sweet spot. As we talked about a few weeks ago, the pendulum always swinging, never stopping. It's who we are. It's what we are, what we were created to be. Keeps life interesting. God knows that. But you know what? In a very real way, especially if we get a little bit of religion in us, we think that we're supposed to be this new, complete creature. And everything is supposed to be wonderful, and we're supposed to be perfect. And suddenly we put this new standard on ourselves that we're supposed to live up to. And of course we can't. Do you know who has to pay the most expensive malpractice insurance of any doctor? It's an obstetrician, gynecologist, the OB-gynies. You know why? Because people come to an OB-gyne expecting a well result. They come well, pregnant, well, and they expect a well baby. And when they don't get it, they go crazy. People that go to other doctors are already sick. They don't know what to expect. Malpractice insurance for obstetricians is through the roof. Many of them have been driven out of the business because people expect a well result. When we get a little religion in us, we expect a well result, and we go crazy when we don't get it. Well, guess what? You're still human, and you will be until the day you die. And maybe even after that, I don't know. But the point is, we start to expect something of us that is unrealistic. I need to speak to you one of the deepest truths that I can say, and I hope that you'll hear it. You don't have to change. You don't even have to give up your sin. You don't have to have a conversion experience in order to have God's love and God's acceptance. Does that sound completely heretical? Are you looking for rocks right now? You don't have to change, give up your sin, or even have a conversion experience in order to have God's love. It's who He is and not what He does. God is love. If you approach Him, you get it. If you run and hide, you hide from it. But it's still there. It's like the sun. It's shining full blast in every possible direction at once. You can't avoid it except to go stand in the shade. God's life, God's love is exactly that way. It's a fire hydrant. It's one pressure all the time. Go take a drink. Or don't. But it's there. Does He want you to change? Does He want you to give up your sin? Does He want you to have a conversion experience? Of course. But it has nothing to do with how He feels about you. You don't have to get fixed before you can have a relationship. If you did, we'd all be doomed. Because how can we have a relationship if we have to get fixed first? It is through the relationship that we get fixed. Remember when the Pharisees and the other religious leaders bring a woman to Jesus in the courtyard and say she was caught in the very act of adultery? Moses says that we should stone her. What do you say? And of course, they're trying to trap Him. And He does an interesting thing. He just stoops down and He's doodling in the dust of the pavement of the courtyard as if He hadn't heard them. And they persist and they persist and then they ratchet themselves up. And here's this poor woman, you know, laying here wondering what's happening next. And he simply then addresses them and stands up and he says, "Those of you without sin, cast the first stone." Well, if you know what the rabbis said about capital punishment, there was supposed to have been a 10 to 12 foot scaffold, and the woman was taken up there with the witnesses who saw her. And the first witness would push her off with some force, with her hands tied behind her back. And if a fall didn't kill her, then the second witness would take a huge stone and crush her with it, the coup de grace. That was the preferred method that the rabbis suggested. Jesus is saying, which one of you witnesses is worthy to cast that first stone, to proceed with this execution? And of course, they drift off. And then he says to the woman, where are your accusers? Has anyone accused you? No, sir, not one. Neither do I condemn you. Try to imagine Jesus' face at that moment, looking into her eyes, looking into your eyes right now. What are they filled with? Loathing and disgust because of what she did? Go and sin no more, he says to her. Yes, please, repair your life. Start to live in such a way that your relationships are solid, that you can walk out in the light of day in the community and take bread from another's hands. Sin no more so you can be part of life and light and love. But right now, I couldn't love you any more if I tried. And there is nothing you can do to make me love you any more than I do right now. And there's nothing you can do to turn this light off that you see in my eyes. Can you close your eyes and imagine what that looks like? Have you seen that kind of love in the eyes of another? This is what Jesus is trying to get across to us. This is what finding the face of God is all about. I was reading an article that was completely unrelated, and I came across this line. It was about the green movement, I think, or something. But the point the man was making was, you know, we shouldn't judge anybody. Don't you judge, I won't judge, because may we all find mercy when we stand alone, naked, and ashamed before the judgment of God. I want you to think about that. May we all find mercy when we stand alone, naked, and ashamed before the judgment of God. I've heard that in so many ways. We have whole movies and scenarios about when we stand before God at the end of all things, you know, and there's just going to be this tape played of our life and how ashamed we're going to feel. When you are standing before your God, the God who is love, the God who is forgiveness, doesn't do those things, is those things, is deliverance, is salvation, is compassion, mercy, kindness, loyalty, devotion. What do you think you're going to feel at that moment? In one moment, filled with the presence of God, God who is all these things, there won't be room for anything else. There won't be a shred of you that could think about past or future. Everything will be contained all in all in this moment, right here, right now. That's who our God is, filling us with these things. And we stand shaking in our boots, wondering if we're accepted. Everything I have is yours, he told the elder brother, the prodigal. From the beginning of time, it has been so. There has never been a moment where everything I have has not been yours, that I haven't loved you with this love. If you can get that, then go and sin no more. If you can get that, then go and start living your life in kingdom to the fullest. That's the message here. We have to run against the current of our own deeply ingrained beliefs, even if they're subconscious, against the belief systems of our society and our church even, to find the face of God as Jesus is showing him to us. I put Psalm 103 in the handouts today. Listen to Psalm 103 in light of everything that we've been saying for the last few minutes. And see if you can't hear David speaking of his God. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget none of his benefits. Benefits is kind of a cold word, but it means blessings. It means don't forget everything that your God has done for you. Remember those things? Remember when you saw his face? Don't forget. The God who pardons all your iniquities, who heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from the pit, who crowns you with loving kindness and compassion, who satisfies your years with good things so that your youth is renewed like the eagle. The Lord performs righteous deeds and judgments for all who are oppressed. Judgments is a difficult word for us, but here it means deliverance for those who are oppressed, righting the wrongs for those who have been wronged. He made known his ways to Moses. His acts are to the sons of Israel. The Lord is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in loving kindness. That word, chesed, loving kindness, mercy, compassion, loyalty, devotion, all those things. He will not always strive with us, nor will he keep his anger forever. He has not dealt with us according to our sins, nor rewarded us according to our iniquities. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his loving kindness toward those who fear him, who worship him, who come into his presence. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us. Just as a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him. For he himself knows our frame, our feeble frame. He is mindful that we are but dust. As for man, his days are like grass. As a flower of the field, so he flourishes. When the wind has passed over it, it is no more, and its place acknowledge it no longer. But the loving kindness of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting on those who fear him, and his righteousness to children's children. To those who keep his covenant and remember his precepts to do them, the Lord has established his throne in the heavens, and his sovereignty rules over all. Bless the Lord, you his angels, mighty in strength, who perform his word, obeying the voice of his word. Bless the Lord, all you his hosts, you who serve him, doing his will. Bless the Lord, all you works of his, in all places of his dominion. Bless the Lord, O my soul. If we could really believe that, right down to our socks, life would never be the same. If we could really believe that, if we could see the face of our Father, the face of our God in front of us, looking at us with the eyes that he has for us, the fear that we feel would begin at least to dissipate. And we would be free to live in a new way. We've been given two tools, and that is thought and action. That's basically it. We don't have control over much else. And these words that you hear today, even if you think that they sound right, even if you think that you want to believe, you choose to believe, if it doesn't change your actions, nothing changes in your life. This is not an academic exercise. It's not an intellectual endeavor. It is life, lived in every detail and every relationship. If we, by talking here, can get the first glimpse of another there out there, another way of thinking, that then can create a new way of acting, then we're doing something worthwhile. If not, then it's a pleasant time together, but it goes no further. Take these thoughts, read the scriptures over with this in mind, and see if you don't see what I see. What Jesus is trying to tell us and show us about his Father, and see if in the interactions today, right now, during our breakfast, that in another's face you can't find the face of your Father, the face of your God. And then eventually you can find that same face when you look in the mirror, because you have become the person who can be that kind of friend, who will just be there for another, no matter what. I wanted to end with a benediction that Brennan Manning gave, that he attributes to his spiritual mentor, a man named Larry Hine. And I love it because it's so paradoxical. But think about it. May all your expectations be frustrated. May all your plans be thwarted. May all your desires be withered into nothingness, that you may experience the powerlessness and poverty of a child, and sing and dance in the compassion of God, who is Father, Son, and Spirit. It's no accident that Jesus kept holding children up to us. Let us just move into that place where we can let go and find the face of our God. Let's pray. Father, sometimes it's just hard to know where to begin. To thank you, to begin to be grateful. Sometimes it's just hard to know where to begin at all. But if we can begin here and get a glimpse of who you are, it can spur us on to everything that you have for us. Continue to show us who you are, as you always do, Lord. Break down whatever fears are in us that are keeping us clinging to that last thing that separates us from you and your face. We want to be yours completely and wholly. We want to live our dependence and our powerlessness in you. And we want to find everything that you have for us in each other through you, your Son, your Spirit. Thank you, Father, in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Let's all stand.